This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Rob Williams. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboy. This is our Talksplode podcast. This is the creator interview conversation show. I think this show was due in February, but let's not talk about that. I'm excited to talk to Rob Williams today. In about a 20-year career in comics, he's worked a lot on Judge Dredd in 2000 AD, but with plenty of American comics as well, at Marvel and DC, and a whole bunch of great creator-owned projects. Most recently, Petrolhead from Image Comics, with artist Pi Par, has just been blowing us away. I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to Rob, a really thoughtful writer, and let's just get to it. Hey, I'm Josh Flanagan. I am here with Rob Williams. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Josh. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to get you on the show. I admit I've seen a lot of your work. I've read a lot of your work over the years, and it sort of stands out to me, but I'm going to tell you I have a relative ignorance of Judge Dredd, and this is me saying I know that everybody in the world knows it, and I'm not going to try to fake it that I know it really well, but I do have questions, and I'm interested in it, and so don't be surprised when I have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to Dredd.
Don't be surprised when I have very little idea about what I'm talking about when I answer your questions, but I'll give it a go.
That's absolutely fair, and I think we can go with that. So how did you – were you always a comics kid? How did you – come to the art form? How was comics part of your life early on?
It just kind of always was. I just remember sort of being brought sort of, you know, Marvel reprints in the UK. We used to get sort of black and white reprints of old, you know, Spider-Man, Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And then there was a great bunch of amazing British comics, things like a bit later on 2000 AD, which was huge for my generation and remains so. But yeah. There was comics when you were a kid about all, there was like football comics, there was Roy of the Rovers, there was battle, there was war comics. And so that was just something I always loved. And then, you know, when I hit about 15, it was the first time I ever went to a independent comic shop. I didn't even, because where I grew up was like nowhere near, there were no comic shops. They were barely shops, Josh, to be honest with you. And when you're a kid, what you used to do is they would bring old DC comics over as ballast for ships. This is absolutely true. And so you would go into a newsagent and you would kind of go, oh my God, what's this? This amazing sort of Justice League issue where they were fighting Darkseid. And you would never, never, ever, there'd be an amazing cliffhanger. You would never, ever get to see the second part. So that a deeply flawed storytelling sense of narrative is embedded in me from that point, basically. And then, like I say, about 15, 16, found out there was, you know, got to a an actual comic shop, which was Forever People in Bristol. That was huge for me. And the first time I ever went in, the timing being so perfect, I picked up like two issues of Watchmen, one issue of Dark Knight Returns. You know, not a bad pivotal sort of first comic.
Was that about when those came out? Were those contemporary?
Yeah. That's like they were released then. And I just happened to walk in. And because I knew Alan Moore from writing for 2000 AD, I went, oh, I'll pick this up. And then, you know, who knew?
How old are you?
I was probably, well, this is, I would say 86, 15. So I would have been 15 years old, maybe.
Okay.
So, like, just the peak time. But it was never kind of like, so anyway, long story short, comics were always part of my life. Loved collecting them, loved X-Men, and I loved Marvel and DC and 2000 AD. And I never, ever thought I'd do it for a living because I just didn't think you could. I mean, I grew up in the South Wales Valleys, which is a very industrialized part of the UK, which is several hours away from sort of, you know, any major city. It was just not something, you know, I had no contemporaries or no relatives who worked as writers or anything. Everyone worked like as lorry drivers and worked on a local factory and things like that. So it was just not a possibility. But I decided to be a journalist, and long story short, I worked as a journalist for several years. And I thought I'd write one comic, and I just, you know, just to scratch the itch, because I'd always loved comics, and that was called Class War, and it was released, I'm going to say 2001, through a small independent British company called Comex. And Class War did very well, got good reviews, and suddenly, you know, Marvel and DC in 2000 AD were asking me if I wanted to pitch for them, and suddenly it opened up new avenues for me. And, you know, I spent a large part of my career, first 10 years probably my comics career, I was a journalist at the same time as I was writing comics. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of, then the journalism went away, and I've just been pretty much doing comics apart from some film and TV stuff ever since.
Let me go back a little bit. So when you're, you know, younger and you're into comics, is it everybody around, like, or do your friends read comics too? Or is that like, this is the thing you have, you know, is it,
it's kind of
at a certain point there was the comic book nerd thing that isn't really around anymore. But when you were younger, were you all on your own or?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, which sounds very sad, but it's like, no, but it was a friend of mine.
not to me. I understand.
There was a friend of mine who he had comics as well. And but there was not a big comic scene in my school, put it that way. It was kind of just me. But there was a great kind of joy in going. There was a local market in a place called Pontypridd, and you'd go down there, they had just reams and reams of secondhand Marvel and DC books, and you'd come back with packs of them, and it was that was like my little happy place, and you know you get it. But I genuinely didn't know. I went to my first comic convention in, I'm gonna say, 2001, you know, I
after you were published?
Just before, because that was when I went to the first comic convention and comics were there, and I brought in this script and handed it to them. This big, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know you had to pitch. I just didn't know what I was doing, and I just go, I've written a script. Here you go. And then 3 months later, I think they rang me out of the blue, and they said, we've read this and we really like it. So it was like a very lucky right place, right time, because otherwise it probably never would have happened for me.
So when you decided to write a comic script, how did you know where to start? How did you know what format to use? I have a lot of questions about it. So go with that. Like, you thought, oh, I'm going to write a comic script. Where do you go from there?
I think it was, at the time, it's pre-internet. That's how old I am.
Yeah,
But I think in the back of the Sandman graphic novel, there was a script. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was the full script, but there was pages of script. And that was kind of like, oh, okay, that's how you do it. Because it would just seem like some weird mystery prior to that. And I think as well in a Judge Dredd annual in the 80s, John Wagner, who's like one of the great all-time comic writers and you know, a legend in the British scene, there was one of his Judge Dredd scripts. And again, it was – And Wagner's scripts are very, very really good. If you want to get into writing comics, read Wagner's scripts, because it's very sort of terse and very, there's no meat on the bones, and it's kind of, so that was a very good way of sort of cutting out any kind of extraneous bullshit you might, you know, feel, oh, I'm going to splash my ego all over the page. And Wagner's scripts are very, here's exactly what an artist needs and no more. So, yeah, I mean, it was that. But then even then you go into your first one and you don't know what you're doing. So you're going, oh, I'll write 9-panel pages on several pages in a row. And any artist within their right mind is going to throttle you if they get that script. So, you do a lot of your learning on the job and in public, really. And which is, I guess, how it should be. You just need to have patient people with you who recognize you've got a bit of talent, but perhaps your grasp of a form needs a bit of work.
So were you a kid, you went into journalism, but were you a kid who had stories in your head, things that you wanted to tell, you know, fiction?
I could see sort of ideas for films and things like that, but I just didn't have structure. I just really did. I mean, a big thing for me, and I was several years into being, and I studied creative writing in college. I did a degree and I specialized in creative writing, where I learned nothing and was taught absolutely nothing. They just sat us in a room every day with a bunch of other people on the course, and we would all read our stories to each other. And the lecturer would then say, well, what did you all think of Rob's story? And everyone would stick their oar in. But no one taught you basic writing structure. And I think if you want to do this for a living, that's what you need to grasp more than anything else, because you can have talent and all these things, but you know, having a fundamental understanding of story, you know, right. A story starts, middle, ends, what the people want, what's stopping them getting it, all these building block things, which, you know, just about every story that we love has, you need to learn those to actually do this for a living. Because, you know, I've said many times, most days you sit down and you are not particularly inspired. The muse does not come down to you, you know what I mean? But you kind of go, oh, I kind of know what a story needs. And it's almost like learning to be a carpenter. You know what I mean? You just the difference in sort of like a rickety chair, which might look beautiful, but it's going to fall apart the first time anyone sits on it, compared to a really solidly structured piece of furniture, which is a very unglamorous way to talk about writing. But I think what you do is you kind of, when you have that down, when you've learned these basic structural rules, then you can build beautiful things on top of it, and it'll stand up. But I went to I forget at which point in my career it was, maybe 5 years into my comics career. And I went to, there's a screenwriting guru called Robert McKee, who does these lectures around the world. And I went to see him in London for about 3-4 days. And I learned more in 3-4 days with Robert McKee than I did in 3 years of my degree, to be honest with you, specializing in creative writing. And it was all this type of stuff, you know, and there's a lot of books out there which teach you about screenwriting structure and they're enormously useful, but also I know a lot of people are very down on them because they feel quite rightly that they can teach formulaic writing. And absolutely mm-hmm. That's true. But I always think, like, before someone like Miles Davis learned to be the greatest jazz musician in the world, he learned basic musical structure and then he ripped it all apart and did whatever he wanted with it. So I think you've got to learn these things. And then once you've got that, your craft down, then you're free to sort of be as creative as you want to be within that.
So how long are you into making comics professionally, not necessarily as your career, when you feel like you have a handle around that concept of story? Because it is one of those things where eventually you hear, you know, professional writers can really break it down and talk about it, you know, in a concise way. And then, as you said, lay those things around it. When did you... I will hear professional writers talk and I'm like, wow, where did you learn this part? When did that come along? So for you, when did you, you know, when did you understand it in that way, that sort of, you know, the bones of the, Jeff Johns explained this to me, where he said it to me once, where he's like, if you're an architect, you would go into a house and you would see how the structure is. And he's like, and that's what I ended up doing with story. And I was like, yes, it makes you annoying to watch TV with. And he said, yes. Yeah. But when did you sort of get your head around that?
I'm a long time in, and this is, I think, partly mm-hmm. where you learn on the job, and sometimes you get opportunities early days in your career, and you're not ready for it because you don't have those basic structures down. But you've got enough about you, I guess, for people to keep to hire you because there's exciting things you're doing, or there's, you know, inventive things, or stuff that's just fun on the page. Good grasp of character. You've always probably got these things in your locker.
Yeah,
but you don't have them. You're not fully formed yet. You know, and I think so. Part of it is working as well with, you know, with good editors, but there's a lot of good editors out there. There's a lot of bad editors out there who don't, you know, don't help you with this stuff when perhaps you could use it. You know, I mean. You've got to kind of, like, I think you do your own learning, but, and part of it is you are chipping away as you go. But I would say, I mean, I've probably been doing comics for over 20 years now, maybe yeah. 20, 22, it might be longer. I'm probably sort of 10 years in before I kind of go, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, oh, I had it and everything from 10 years on is a perfect piece of work. Sure. You still screw up. Do you know what I mean? You can still kind of go three quarters of the way through a story sometimes and go, why isn't this bloody thing working? There's something fundamental that it's missing. So it's easy to miss things. But I do think the basics, you know, once you kind of have a good, solid sense of the basics of storytelling, then, it's tough to do a fundamentally bad piece of work. But I'm sure I can find a way to do it if I really try.
So Class War gets... published, and I'm not going to tell you that I remember anything about the story, but I do remember a friend of mine recommending it to me at that time. So I can tell you that I was in Los Angeles at the time. I want to say is that my roommate was like, you got to read this book. And so it made that word of mouth thing around. And it was early in those days. Comex. I don't know if, was that a website also?
Yeah. But they were a design company in London. They'd made a bunch of money from design work, and they were comic fans. And they decided that, like, oh, we're going to go out and we're going to take over the comics industry, which they didn't achieve. But what they did achieve, what they were very good at, is having an eye for young talent. They hired people like Ben Oliver, me, Trev Hairsign, Neil Googe, and they put together this really kind of – there was a lot of energy about it at the time, and, you know, and the realities of the industry, I think, just sure. couldn't withhold. They came in going, we're going to do amazing paper stock and it's going to be beautiful to hold. It's absolutely true. But that kind of destroys any profit immediately.
I've heard that story. There's been a bunch of publishers who did that. Yeah.
It's like, why can't comics be the most beautiful things to hold and feel and touch? And you go, yeah, because no one makes any money out of it. but it, like, you know, they had great intentions and you know, they gave me a chance, so God bless them. But it's...
You went in with a script. There wasn't finished art, right? Is that, or did you have it drawn?
Again, sorry?
You went in with, you just had a script, right? They weren't like finished pages? That's crazy.
They introduced me to Trev Hairsign, and, you know, Trev's, you know, an amazing artist. Got, like, you know, he's got the power of Neil Adams about his work, and sort of bits of Jim Lee in there as well. And so I was just incredibly fortunate. They teamed me up with a great artist, and then Trev and I got to be, you know, good friends, and we worked closely together on it. And then after three issues, Marvel basically saw what Trev was doing, and they pinched him to go off and do Captain America, if I remember right. So then I was kind of, oh, well, that's the end of Class War. And then Comex went, well, we got this other guy we found called Travel Foreman, and Travel was just...
Jeez.
Yeah, again, just unbelievably good. So I just sort of completely fell on my feet, and just, like, the first two artists I got to work with were just... fantastic, and both very different, but very, very right for that book. There's a huge amount of power and cinematic sort of energy about it, and there's bits of Akira in there and all kinds of things. But it's kind of it's a bit me flailing around, not 100% knowing what I'm doing. But I kind of compare it to sort of when a punk band does their first album. Mm-hmm. They might only have four chords, but you can write some good songs with four chords. Do you know what I mean?
I do. So it sounds like you look back on it with some sort of pride, not like, oh, no, that's awful.
No, absolutely. And we re-released it last year through Image, and yeah. I hadn't read it for a while. And it's a weird experience. You're reading one page kind of going, I wish I could write as good as that now. And then you read another page, and then you go, well, that's not great, that page. And then you read the next scene, and you go, that's an amazing scene. So it kind of, it flits back and forth between sort of me kind of being a bit in awe of what I was able to accomplish at that point, and me also wanting to go in and edit it at times as well.
How did you find sort of the process of taking your words and then working with an artist to sort of, you know, the writing them and thinking of it as one thing, and then you sort of hand it over. Was it a long process to sort of learn how to build those pages visually when you weren't doing the art?
No. I mean, that's one thing I've always been very good at, I think, is the visual, writing visuals and writing with a visual sense. I write full script, and I think from word one, I just kind of, it's quite, I can't draw, but I can see how it's going to look. I mean, very often, you know, you hand your script over and one artist will take what you've written. You can be very exact in your instructions and they can come up with something completely different. And as long as the narrative point is hit, then and as long as it looks good, I don't care. You know what I mean? It's like, but no, I think I've always written visually. I struggle a bit with Marvel style, which is just purely, you know, writing the plot beats. I think I can see sequences and I can see sort of, you know, interactions and so I'm trying to describe that to the artist. And so I like to think, well, I've been told by quite a few artists in the past that I think my scripts are quite easy to work with in that regard. They want to kill me sometimes. I did a book with Walt Simonson a few years ago for DC, and I was at a convention with him and I asked him to sign my copy. And when it came back, he'd written, "Next time, pal, a more challenging script, please," which was, I think he was being sarcastic.
He's like the nicest man I've ever met.
I may have asked quite a lot.
That's, I mean, you know, good for you. So do you, I'm guessing that means that you're pacing out the pages and like how many panels and things like that, but leaving it up to the artist largely, or are you more specific?
No, I'm very exact, but it depends on who you're working with, but I don't mind at all if you're working with someone good, who's a really good visual storyteller, if they want to add panels, remove panels, you know, fine, because I know they'll tell the story. But I think the problem you get is sometimes you don't know who you're working with and you hand your script over and when they reinterpret it, and perhaps they might not be the strongest visual storyteller and their choices might not be contrary to what you had in mind. And that's when a comic struggles. I mean, I think this is, you know, if you're working with people, you know, and you've worked with a bunch of times in the past and you hand them a script and they go, "I might try something different." I've just done this Judge Dredd story with Henry Flint, who's a phenomenal artist. And, you know, unfortunately the American market doesn't really know a lot of Henry's work, but he is genuinely, I think, one of the major talents in the industry. And Henry, we've worked together a bunch, and Henry said, "Look, I might try something different with this and add a lot of panels and stuff." I'm like, "You go for it, because I know it's all going to sing," you know, when he does it, because, you know, we've got that trust. But a lot of the times when you work for publishers like Marvel and DC, and you're not aware of who's going to be drawing the script. And so it's always a little bit of an adventure with what comes back at that, you know, in those circumstances. Sometimes a good adventure and sometimes a not so good adventure.
So what's sort of the next step? Classwork comes out. They steal Trevor Harris, sign you end up with Travel Foreman, which is not a bad consolation prize. Where do you go from there? I mean, we're talking about, we have an internet now, but social media is not until later. Like, what do you decide? What do you want to do? What's your goal at that point? And how do you get there?
I didn't really know if I could do it for a living. I thought I'd done it once, and it's just like, well, you know, I'll keep my oar in, and because I wanted to do more of it. And then 2000 AD asked me to pitch for them, and I did. And I started writing for 2000 AD, and I wrote a story called Asylum, which is, you know, classic second album syndrome of just me going, "Oh, okay, I did it once, I can do it again," and then just not really know where I'm going. But fortunately, 2000 AD stuck with me, and beyond that, because that's not the best story. I wouldn't recommend that one. But then at the same time, there was learning pains where, your Marvel basically said, "You know, what do you want to write for us?" And I said, "Well, I want to do a Captain Britain." I think I'm remembering this right. I'd like to do a Captain Britain miniseries. I went, "Yeah, fine." And then I kind of went through, I don't know, five, maybe more iterations of a plot breakdown of this thing. And then eventually Marvel come back and kind of go, I don't think this is working, you know? And so that was really disappointing because I thought, well, this was my in with Marvel. And I think that around about the same time, I think DC, Dan Didio said, what do you want to do? And I went, I want to do a Superman, a Superman book. And I think this roughly the same thing happened. So I was kind of hitting my head a little bit and kind of wondering, well, because it's like that, I think it's that story structure thing I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. You get opportunities and maybe you're not quite ready for it yet. And so I'm working for 2000 AD. And then I think I started doing Star Wars books for Dark Horse. I did that for quite a while and worked with some cool people there, people like Dustin Weaver, drew a few of the issues. I was a Star Wars fan growing up. And you're kind of slowly kind of rolling along and doing 2000 AD in the background. And then eventually, I genuinely forget the timing. I started doing some work for Marvel again. And I worked for Marvel for a few years, I think. Axel Alonso was, I think, quite a proponent of me at Marvel, from what I remember. And myself and a friend, Lawrence Campbell, who I've done a bunch of books with over the years, we pitched a Sunfire miniseries, the X-Men, to Axel Alonso. And I remember Axel ringing us up and he goes, well, we love the pitch, but we can't do it because he had his legs cut off in the X-Men book last week. And I think I sort of said, well, look, you know, he can fly. Can we? And then we realized the public are not necessarily ready for a hovering, stumpy Sunfire miniseries. So then I think Axel said something like, do you want to write an X? Do you want to do a Wolverine book together? I was just like, yeah, great. So, suddenly then I was working for Marvel.
Were you very up to date or at least really familiar with those? I know you'd grown up reading them, but as you sort of were in your adult life and you know, were you keeping up with the characters? Were you... You know.
I think at that point I was, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I think I largely knew what was going on. I wasn't sort of, I was, my comic buying was still probably quite extensive at that point. I think I may have hit a bump again there. I did a really good Punisher book with Lawrence for Marvel, which again is called Get Castle, and which mm-hmm. I still is one of the better things I've done, I think, that as a one-off issue. But again, I couldn't seem to sustain it or get a regular gig there. And I think it's a few years further on before Marvel offered me. Well, I did a Ghost Rider series for Marvel and I did a Dakin series for Marvel at the same time. So, you're kind of plugging away all the time and you feel like with the major publishers, at various points the doors are open and various points the doors are shut, and you're never quite sure. You're kind of going, I'm still kind of the same guy. That was fun for a few years.
It's really interesting because I always sort of that in the late 90s, that sort of Marvel Knights period till Twitter, basically. So like say 98 to 2007-08 was this really interesting time. Because Marvel was almost like rebuilding themselves to a certain extent. And people got chances sometimes, it still happens now, but got chances maybe before they were ready a lot of times. Yep. And I remember I made my, everybody who talks about comics is like, I think I could write comics. And I made my little stint at it. And the thing that always sort of scared me was the idea that, and it didn't happen, but somebody just saying like, do you have a Superman story in you? And I just go, no. Or, you know, like that's what I'd think, but you'd have to go, yes. And then, you know, show up there at the thing, you know, so if somebody says to you, you know, do you have a, you know, you said Captain Britain right away. Did you have a Captain Britain story in your head?
I had the sort of outline for what I wanted to do. I didn't sort of have certain aspects of the story sort of nailed down. And the problem with that is, again, I think a lot of people make this mistake, which I certainly did. I've got so much reverence for the, you know, the Alan Moore, Alan Davis, Captain Britain run is one of my favorite comics of all time. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of go, oh, I want to do that. But then you kind of go, well, it's a bit like going, well, I love the Beatles, so I'd like to do an album that's like the Beatles. And you kind of go, no, don't do that. That's a really bad idea. You know, you kind of like, don't follow some of the greats. I mean, you kind of, I think when you get older and you know yourself a bit more and you know your interests and you know what makes you passionate and what you, when you write, what you're good at writing and other things that perhaps you may not be as good at writing, then you can pick your battles a bit more favorably. But a lot of the time with working for Marvel and DC, you know, people occasionally go, well, we wanted to do this. And you don't really go, well, I don't want to do that. I want to do, you know, whatever, sort of, I want to do an Inhumans book or something like that. They might go, well, we don't want to do the Inhumans. There's a slot for you on Ghost Rider or Deacon or something. You go, okay. And then you go away and you, like you said, you do that thing where you kind of go, I'd love to do that. And then you spend an entire weekend freaking out trying to come up with something. Where you kind of go, absolutely, I've got a story. It's long been my dream to write character X, who I've got no story for. And you build one and you do it very quickly.
So you've pretty much been working for 2000 AD that whole time. Is that correct? I mean, more or less. Now, in the UK, in much of the world, you know, that's a standard. I actually looked it up, and it said, you know, I think 2000 AD started in February of 1977. I was like, that's exactly when I started too. So it is this constant that has sort of been in the background. And I think for Americans, you know, I know about it, obviously. I've read Judge Dredd stories. I've seen movies and things like that. But largely, you know, those creators would come to us for me, like via Vertigo or something like that. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, is 2000 AD have a feeling like I made it? Or is 2000 AD feel like, okay, I've made it this far, and now this is a stepping stone to doing, you know, American comics or something like that? How did you approach all that?
Well, I think there was a period where that was seen as the definite step. In, you did 2000 AD, and then Vertigo, you know, plucked you, and you went off and did Hellblazer for a while, and then you're away. You're into the American market. I think by the time I came in to 2000 AD, I think that I just missed that period. I mean, just like in the years prior, there was probably 5 years before, there was people like Mark Miller and Grant Morrison were doing 2000 AD. Garth Ennis was... they were all writing Judge Dredd. But then there was people, you know, like, you know, John Smith and Pete Milligan. And, you know, I mean, basically it was like a university for American comics. And what, you know, some of the biggest names in American comics. I think that kind of largely came to a screeching halt, largely about the time when I kind of got to 2000 AD. I think the difference for me with it was... I grew up reading 2000 AD, and I loved 2000 AD, and I loved American comics as well. So I never really saw it as a stepping stone. I just went, well, I'll do both. And really enjoyed doing both. I think, you know, for people like your Dave Gibbons and your Brian Bolland and Alan Moore, you know, they basically large buckets of money were put in front of them and say, come over, and why would you go back? You know, it's just, you can make a lot more money in the States, and they did. But I think sort of, you know, there were people like in my era, coming into 2008, people like myself, Andy Diggle, Cy Spurrier, I'm saying who else, Fraser Irving, Jock, you know, Jock went on to, you know, we all kind of were roughly starting about the same time.
Okay, yeah.
And we've all gone off to do American work, but I mean, there's someone like Jock is interesting who plainly just has a deep-rooted love for Judge Dredd, you know, but... I think the American market pays a lot more, and he's doing well there. But it's, but yeah, but even when I was like, I was doing an awful lot of work for DC about 8 years ago. I was doing Suicide Squad with Jim Lee, and I still kept my hand in with 2000 AD because I just enjoy it. And I also had a thing when I was a kid. It always pissed me off when creators would vanish. Do you know what I mean? I do a story every now and again. It's not going to kill you, you know. But so I
British comic thought, sellouts.
Yeah, so I thought I'm going to do that, and you, because Dredd stories are sort of like six pages, you know, you can do a Dredd story every now and again, and it doesn't kill you. So come on, forget money in American market creators. Come back to 2018.
Were you? I mean, how long? You were still doing journalism during this time, and I'm curious, what does journalism mean in this context? What are you writing for? What are you writing about?
I was a magazine journalist, but that's how I trained, and then I freelanced for a lot of years. I worked for a video production company for a few years, and that actually helped prompt me into writing comics, because I was writing scripts for visuals, and very boring subject matter occasionally, but I kind of thought, well, that started me writing scripts. And so I thought, if I'm doing that, maybe I can write a comic script. But the journalism, it was I was sub-editing. I was doing, for about 2 years, I was basically just going in and just freelance sub-editing on any magazine that would have me. And after a while, that gets a little soul-crushing because you're the guy who comes in and does a week and, you know, you don't talk to people and you go and at the end of it and you're not invested in any kind of way. But I was occasionally I would write features for, you know, big magazines like GQ. GQ flew me out to, I had a couple of cool ones. They flew me out to Jackson, Mississippi to interview Reggie Bush, the American footballer, at the New Orleans Saints training camp. It was hotter than the face of the sun. And I'd flown all the way to Jackson, Mississippi, and then Reggie Bush refused to be interviewed by us. I remember that. That was good.
Did you know anything about American football?
Yeah, I'm a big. That's why I got the gig. I'm a big sort of U.S. football fan, and always have been, and remain so. But and another time they flew me out to cover the NFL draft in Radio City Music Hall in New York City. That was great. But the majority of my journalism jobs were not as exciting as that. And I was doing.
Was that your hook, being like the British guy who loves American football?
I got those things like, because I just looked around and like no one else knew anything about it, and I did. So they went, "Do you want to come to New York and cover the draft?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." But I mean, I did a bunch of music journalism, and you know, I've interviewed all kinds of people in music journalism. I interviewed Taylor Swift. I talked to Taylor Swift for about when she was just starting out. So I had that kind of career going on, but it was just the comic stuff was getting more and more and more. And I had one being honest, I had one regular gig in my journalism side of things, and that magazine shut down. And just out of panic alone, I started pitching a lot of comic gigs, and suddenly I had time to invest in my comics career, which I never really had before. And of course, just the more you pitch, the more gigs you get, and suddenly I was doing more comic work when I was journalism.
It's really, you're talking about working in magazines, and I thought, I think you just named one of the only industries that's less stable than comics as we sort of move into the latter part of that decade.
Yeah, I know. It's like, choose your destructive career path. You can either go down path A or path B. It's got hard. I've still got friends who are still in the journalism industry, and I saw one of them a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about, he was telling me about the magazine shutting down, and I was talking to him, but telling him about the comic shop sort of shutting down. So yeah, it's fun times.
All that paper. So you sort of said you did a comic script as a lark. I mean, was that your goal to make comics, or was it a larger one to tell stories, you know, and then you know, comics is your vessel, you know, up to this point. And I know that TV and film sort of follows that. To a certain extent, but like, is that what you wanted to do? Was that your dream, I guess?
No, and like I said, Josh, I mean, earlier on, I genuinely mean it. I didn't know it was possible to do it. So I thought, right, well, I'll do one. And because I've always loved comics, I don't recall having a great plan to do it for a living. And I didn't even know if I was capable of doing it for a living. I sort of, because I didn't know if I had a number of stories in me. And it's only when you start doing it for a living and you realize, you know, necessity actually can push amazing things out of you, because you start doing it. And for instance, you know, if you've got deadlines, you can sit down at a computer and go, I got nothing today. I've got nothing. And then lo and behold, you can have a really good story by the end of the day. And it's because you sat there at the computer and you actually made it happen. And I don't think, before I started in this business, I was sort of, when I had my first comic published, if you told me that I've written all the things I've written, I would not believe you, because it's been in a kind of unexpected, very sort of, I'd bite my arm off to sort of, if you went, you're going to have written for Marvel, DC, 2000 AD, you're going to have written all these things, I wouldn't believe it at all, because I wasn't that sort of like hungry guy going, this is what I'm going to do, because I just genuinely didn't think it was possible to do it.
What do you do when you have a deadline, you've got, you know, a keyboard in front of you, you need to have a story for something? Like, where do you start?
you just start. And that's the hardest thing, I think. You've just got to sit there and just force it into being. And I think what you do is, like, again, I go back to what I said earlier about basic story structure. You kind of go, right, what's this story about? Who's our lead? What do they want? What's stopping them getting what they want? You build up a basic three-act structure, and then you can, from that point on, you kind of go, right, okay, so that's kind of boring. All right, now we need a twist. And it's all largely, you got to dig all these thoughts, you dig down into character. You sort of start thinking about your main characters, and they'll suggest to you where the story should go. And I'm big on theme. I've relaxed on theme a bit, but theme is a big helping hand if you're stuck in a story. Because I always think that there are a billion words. If you sit at a keyboard, right, you can be overawed by the billion options in front of you for any story, right? And as a result, you find a sense of inertia and you don't go anywhere. But if a sense of what this story is about and what you're trying to say in this story, and then you realize, you actually help yourself out through that, because you get to sort of the final act and you kind of go, right, what did my character want? Well, there's only effectively two basic endings here. They either get what they want, we have a happy ending, or they don't get what they want, we have a sad ending. And like I say, you can build all kind of levels of complexity on top of this, and nuance and subtext and, you know, cool set pieces. You need all these kind of things you will add as building blocks. But I do think at its most basic level, you can build a story. And if you do that, you know, I think give yourself small targets. I forget who said it. I think it might have been Kelly Sue McConnick, but she said that I think I read once, it's like you're trying to drive across America at night. You will go, oh my God, I can never do that. But if you go, no, I just need to get to the next town. And once I'm there, then I need to get to the next town. And then I'm there. And eventually, by the end of it, you will have completed, you know, quite a substantial journey. But you need structure to hold the creativity in place. And then the creativity happens within the structure.
And so is your process of sort of creating story generally to think of the sort of story bits, the beginning, middle, and end parts of those, and then flesh it out over? Do you start with, I'm hearing a conversation between two characters in my head? Do you have an outline always when you get going? Or
yeah, sometimes. I mean, how do you go largely about? I have an outline. I try and do beats. You know, I do a beat sheet basically before I go to script for the most part. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, but any rule we talk about here is you can break it. I mean, basically, you can sometimes, if you've just got a great scene in your head, you go, just write the bloody scene down, and we'll find a way to make that work somewhere. You know, similarly, sometimes stories can build out from visuals, and you get there are all kinds of things that can be sort of little sort of seeds for what you're going to do. But for the most part, I'll write out a plot. Then I'll try and break it down into beats, sort of a beat sheet. I'll give it a basic. I want a basic act structure there. I do. I want a midpoint. I want a third act and a sense of, you know, what our twist is going to be, and I want all those in place. And so I've got a sense of where you don't want to overload one half of the story and all the good bits happening in one half of the story. You know, it's like, but really, it's mostly. I think if you're struggling with a story, you have forgotten, and this is really easy to do, you have forgotten what your main character wants. You can get so lost in the weeds of all the other things you're trying to accomplish. And it's like, keep it simple. And it's like, go, right, what do they want? You know, and very often I can get, in the past when I've gone wrong, I think you can get to a point where you realize it's tough to answer that question for certain characters. And then it's like, well, you need to go back to the start and, you know, go again. But it is really, it's building. It's, you know, you just, you build this thing, and then sort of the easy thing is the scripting, I find. I mean, I find dialogue very easy. And then you can have fun. That's not the hard part. The hard part has gone into the plot stuff beforehand, because that can get, that's where you've got to get the sort of, And you, what you want is the really cool moments to happen, to be born out of character. You don't want them to just arbitrarily just be there because they're a cool moment. that's when things really resonate. And I think when you kind of hit, when you're hitting people in the gut and the heart, basically, that's what you're going for. And you've sown those seeds in Act One. If they're happening in Act Three, and again, one of the best bits of writing advice you'll ever hear is Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder said, if there's a problem in your third act, the actual problem isn't in your third act, it's in your first act.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the thing. When you're there going, oh, this isn't working, and you're like 75% of the way in the script, you need to go back to Act One and see how you set those characters up on their journey, and something isn't landing, and it's probably because of there. I'm a sucker for sort of reading. There's a great book, Billy Wilder's Conversations with Cameron Crowe, Billy Wilder gives fantastic sort of writing advice. I mean, I've read a lot of those kind of books over years, and you can always pull something new out of it, which makes you go, oh, okay, that's great. I missed that, you know. So we're always learning.
It's interesting. Clearly, like you said, I didn't learn any of this in creative writing class, but since then you have self-educated through, you know, bringing stuff in and by doing the work and stuff like that. Do you have like peers, storytellers, you know, other comic book writers or artists or whatever that you talk about this stuff with?
We've got online. There's a few of us when we get together at conventions. There's people like Andy Diggle. I think he's you know, Andy's a bit of a buff for this kind of stuff. I've talked with people like Alex Packnadle. We were talking about Dan Harmon's story circle structure and things like this. You can get quite nerdy about it with certain people in the industry because, you know, we all lap this stuff up. We're going, num, 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 num. You know, it's a bit like when artists get together and start talking about pens together and, you know, we're kind of go, oh, no, it's a pen conversation. Well, it's like get a couple of writers together and start talking about story structure and different tricks and, we'll disappear into a corner and lose ourselves. So, but it's the tricks of a trade, right? And it's like it's like when you see a TV show or a film or something and there's a really amazing bit of writing. I love moments like a weird example is, you know, the Disney film Tangled. Have you ever seen Tangled?
I have.
That's a great script. I mean, at the end, when what's his name? Flynn Rider, when he cuts her hair to kind of so he'll die to spoilers to. But to free her from the curse, I actually gasped. And it wasn't just like out loud. And it was a gasp of admiration, pure admiration for the structure of that script and how that had been all set up throughout, you know, and built. And I think, you know, when you see a beautiful piece of writing like that, that's actually, you kind of, you were always looking for things like that. I think writers, we're always, that's the type of stuff that we really admire when people sort of they've set it up and, here's the payoff, and it's like a setup of a good joke. You know what I mean? It's all about the cadence, built, and boom, there's the payoff.
It's one of the payoffs of being a storyteller is that you can appreciate how good some others are when you sort of go through that, and somebody else is going, why is he talking about Tangled? And I'm like, no, that was excellent the way they structured that. That was perfect.
No, it's like I don't think you shut yourself off like for. Yeah, there's good writers out there and working in all kinds of different fields, you know, and it's just, but similarly, like you were saying earlier about Geoff Johns, it's like I've watched a bunch of things lately and I kind of go, I'm 5 minutes in and I'll kind of go, I know what this is. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not great. You kind of feel like a jaded person sat in the cinema going, oh, okay, I see what we're doing here. Do you know what I mean? So
that's not your fault. That's their fault.
Yeah,
I know I am not allowed to tell my wife what's about to happen. And I really have been like, oh, he's the, stop it. And I was like, sorry. And if it's really bad, then you can say exactly what the dialogue's going to be. That's when it's particularly terrible.
That's the worst, isn't it? Yeah. So that's never a good thing. Mostly that's in trailers though, right? It's like any trailer that says the line, let's finish this. You kind of go, all right, I'm gone. I'm out of here. It's,
You're working for 2000 AD, you're doing Dread. Those are short stories, which to me tends to be, as I'm asking it, because there's sort of like a story, but you know, doing a series of short stories, doing a couple of comic books, and then doing a sort of longer, like a Vertigo series, you know, whether it's 6 issues or 24 issues, do you approach those largely the same, or did you have to sort of work out how to approach those things?
I mean, the structural stuff is the same, but it's, mm-hmm. I mean, I think with 2000 AD stories, because there's six pages, Judge Dredd stories, you in episodes, you can have like, I've just done a recent, a nine-parter, but mm-hmm. every episode is about six pages. But then every episode is splits itself up into, it's like a little storytelling sprint, I always think. I always think writers are like athletes. Some writers are really good at, like, they could be sort of marathon runners, mm-hmm. and some are good at just 60-meter tight sprints. And writing Dredd is a bit like that. So you get, like, the first two pages will be your setup. Pages three and four will be, you know, your main character trying to get what he wants, and there's story obstacles, there's a twist, and then all you've got time for then is a cliffhanger, and you're out, basically. And so it's a really turbocharged, effective way of writing stories, with sort of, and you can have a huge amount of fun in that, and I love doing it. I think 2000 AD writers, it's often been said, you learn the bare bones of, like, there's no time to mess around with story. Story has to be tight in these story, in these little tales. So when you go then to the American market and you get 20 pages or 22 pages on a monthly comic, you feel like you have tons of room to play. And a lot of people find that enormously freeing, and I've talked about that. It can also be, I found, you can be about midway through at writing a 20-page comic, 22-page comic, and you can kind of feel like you've got a little bit, maybe this is me, but overthinking it, but you can feel like you're putting too much fat in the bones, you know, and you could do with, mm-hmm. You're being a bit sort of, you're suddenly putting in double page spreads and stuff. Do you know what I mean? And sort of,
Totally. I mean, if you can do 5-6 pages or something like that, then you've learned how to cut out all the unimportant things. So then when you have more room, yes. you're like, well, none of this is important. And that totally makes sense.
But it's like this most recent Dredd I just did, without any spoilers, it's called A Better World, and it's going to be collected next year. And I think it's a beautiful piece of work. And I co-wrote it with Arthur Wyatt, and Henry Flint drew it. So we, yeah, an amazing use of a double page spread in that, where basically we had, but prior to that, we did a really tight sort of 24 panel grid of a build of tension. You know, it was just like a claustrophobic tension build. And then you turn the page, and then you get the double page spread of a really big plot beat in the story. And that's when you're using the kind of the armory of comics, I think, in a really mm-hmm. sort of interesting way. And then, but very often, as we both know, there's way too many American comics where there was a period I remember thinking, there's like five double page spreads in this thing, and it's only 22 pages. And and most of them were of the Hulk punching someone. Do you know? It's like, okay, fine. yeah, so it's kind of, it's a different kind of pacing, but it's like when you get people like Grant Morrison, who can absolutely do both and has done, you know, with great skill and use them both. So I think that I would encourage anyone starting out, try writing 6-page stories or 5-page stories. That'll batter some discipline into you.
Years when I was in the hunt to sort of do this, but we were also doing this stuff full time. I did a show with Andy Schmidt, who was the Marvel editor for a while,
yeah, sure.
and now he runs a school. We did 50 episodes of Make Comics, and one of the things that kept coming up was so many people are like, I have this idea for a graphic novel or a series of whatever, and it was like, do 5 pages.
Yeah.
Try that. Like, first of all, good luck finding an artist to do, you know, but do 5 pages and then you'll really cut it down. I remember the first time, I think I saw a couple of Tom King comics, you know, and he did some of those Vertigo anthologies, and he did one fantastic story with Tom Fowler. And I was like, oh, if you can do those, you're good.
Yeah.
It's always impressive.
No, it's, and I think it's kind of, yeah, that's a really, really good learning point. But it's also even, I just done today, I got pages through. I'm doing a Dredd with R.M. Guerra, who did Scalped most famously. And Guerra and I were talking this morning. These pages had turned up my inbox. And I'm just looking at this Judge Dredd story, which is, we did a 7-page of this particular story. And I'm going, I just asked him to do too much on that page. And the reason for that is because it's 7 pages. You know, it's just like so you have to learn the pace. I'm a bugger for kind of like cramming into I did a book with Mike Mignola about 2 years ago, and the first issue I sent in the plot breakdown. And Mike came back and went, well, if you think you can do all this in one issue. And I was thinking, yeah, of course I can. But it's because I'm used to telling stories in six pages. Sometimes that teaches you bad habits, I think, sometimes when you go into the American market, because you can overcompress. You know,
I chuckled because you said Mike Mignola, and I was like, oh, that's not. You're lucky you get four panels on a Mike Mignola page for the most part.
Yeah, I think Mike read my plot breakdown and kind of was thinking, oh, this guy's, you know, going to cram too much in this. But I think we totally made it work and it breathed. But it's the pacing thing. It's a different kind of pacing. I think we go through different eras with comics. You know, there was that sort of coming off the Authority and things like that.
The Warren Ellis decompressed period.
Yeah, yeah. Then, you know, and then we suddenly, you fast forward and suddenly you've got to today, you've got people like James Tynion and Tom King doing, you know, seem to have gone far away from that, basically. And it's kind of, it's interesting just how, what comes through in vogue, what styles.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch sort of over the last, I've been doing this seriously since about 2005, and I just feel like I'm getting my hand around it, my head around sort of the art form now and figuring out the things I really appreciate. But you can see those sort of trends, but trends, yeah. Is it less than there? It sounds makes it sillier than it is, but it's more just like those movements. So you have people who came up reading Warren Ellis, and they, you know, a bunch of people tried to sort of ape that and it turned into his own thing. And then, you know, those people who tried to ape Alan Moore, but it didn't quite work. And this is just like, you know, music, you know, it's some, you know, everybody heard the Beatles and then you end up getting Black Sabbath out of it, which is, it's a direct line, but that's what happened.
Eventually you end up with Faith No More and who knows what happened there. But anyway, yes.
Yeah. You get Mr. Bungle is what you get.
nice segue. Yeah.
We're getting a little long here, but I did want to ask you is as a person who has been very connected with Judge Dredd for a very long time, What is it about Judge Dredd that has kept him so relevant, both in comics but in British comics? Whereas, you know, in the U.S., I don't know what it is, if it's about the format or whatever. Like, those comics never really became a huge thing here, but is there something that's very British about them, or is it just, you know, the market that they're in? But what is it about – what is it that's great about Dredd to you?
Oh, that's a very...
See how I go around for a while looking for my question, and then you're like, whoa, I wasn't ready.
And you plunge the dagger into the heart with a question. Like,
sorry. Oh,
I could be here for half an hour answering that one. First off, there's the lightning in the bottle thing. Like you said, 2000 AD starts in about 77, and it just so happens that they have a talent pool which is extraordinary. They have Brian Boland and they have Mick McMahon and they have Kevin O'Neill and they have Dave Gibbons and that's like a weekly basis of these guys on a revolving, like Brendan McCarthy. And so you have that, and you also have, like, for me, like two of the greatest writers comics have had, which is John Wagner and Pat Mills, and Alan Grant, three. So there's an amazing talent pool, but Dredd is also this weird mix of it's basically dystopian sort of cautionary sci-fi, but it's got a really great sense of humor. But it's wild and over the top at times. And somehow eventually it settles down to John Wagner as the creator, and John Wagner's his history is very interesting because he's an American who at some point his family moved to Scotland and he grew up in Scotland. So Dredd is this weird kind of...
Because Dredd's American. Megacity One is America.
It's Megacity One is the eastern seaboard of America, right, after a nuclear apocalypse. And the judges are basically what holds what's left of humanity together. And they're fascists. They are an authoritarian regime, and they are... And this is one of the, I think, one of the major reasons why it survived for so long and why it's such an interesting strip is one week Dredd is the bad guy and one week Dredd is the good guy. And somehow they came up with this world where just pretty much all stories are possible. It's an endless story engine. Like you want to do a, sort of a Akira like big sort of sci-fi action thing, you can do that. You want to do a satirical strip, you can do that. You do a tragic, you can do anything week to week, basically, in Dredd. I think the large part of why it's sustained is because John Wagner, for the most, he was writing it at the start, he co-created it, and he's still occasionally writing it, 47 years old, 47 years on. And he's just one of the most amazing writers comics has ever had. And I would sort of, if American audiences don't know his work, I would suggest they go and pick up something like Judge Dredd Case Files 5, I think it is. Let me double check that on my shelf.
Ooh.
Yes. So that's the one.
Study guide.
It's got the Dark Judges, which is drawn by Brian Bolland. And then after that, you get the Apocalypse War, which is drawn by Carlos Escuero, which is this amazing long form. I forget how many parts it is. I'm going to say 30, which is wrong. Which is just basically a big nuclear war between the Soviets and the American judges. It's like a very noirish. Sometimes Dredd's internal monologue is quite Raymond Chandler-esque at times. It can be a police procedural. It can be all these things. I think why it hasn't worked so much in the American market is because, 2000 AD couldn't get the comic shops in America for so long, and even if they did, they were bundled together in sort of weekly packages, which the American market just didn't understand. And then
I think is part of it too is, and when I look at it, and you just said, I could search for a graphic novel of it, and I know about different writers, but there's so much. It's just you don't even. It's difficult to figure out where to sort of start. And I know that it kind of doesn't matter, but American comics are sort of based on that principle to a certain extent.
Yeah, and another thing about it is like they've never rebooted it, so it's still in continuity. I mean, Dredd is aging.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is there one continuity?
Yeah, they never – so Dredd is – God knows, Dredd must be about 70 years old, something like that. Now, as has been explained to me by the editor when I questioned this at one point, the technology that's like, he's got so many cyber optic sort of joints and stuff like that, but he can move like a younger man basically. But that's a kind of an amazing thing, but at some point they're going to have to come up, with a reasoning behind that. But I did a graphic novel a few years ago with Henry Flint called The Small House, which which got a fair bit of acclaim, and I think if people just want to pick up one Dredd story. Oh, I did another one called Titan as well, which was like, that was effectively a bit like Aliens. Dredd and a Marine force go off into space because there's a prison world where the judges send all the judges that have gone bad, and there's a breakout there, so Dredd goes into space to sort it out. And those are self-contained stories you can read in graphic novels. So maybe people, if I'm going to be allowed to plug my own work, then people should look at those.
That's absolutely, absolutely acceptable at this point. I want to talk to you about Petrolhead, and as we sort of close up, because that's sort of the latest thing that has sort of been on my radar. I have been noticing as I was sort of looking around at the work you've done, and I want to say, maybe Royals Masters of War was kind of the first thing that I was reading, because I was a giant Vertigo head when that was all coming out, and so very on top of it. I think that was maybe the first thing of yours that I read that I noticed, and then a little after that, you have Unfollow. Unfortunately, you went down with Vertigo. You took him down with you. I don't know.
It was again, as I said earlier on, about I am the knell of death.
A little too late.
Many companies.
And then they're very different. And then you're writing Roy of the Rovers, which, as far as I can tell, and tell me if this is wrong, this is a long-standing British comic, about a young footballer, and you're just continuing the tradition of that in the same way that you are with Fred. And then I go to Petrolhead, I'm trying to look for a connective tissue for all of these things, where some people. And I don't mean this even as a bad thing, but something like, oh, okay, I can sort of see what they're getting at all the time. And then there's other people who's like, I just want to tell a bunch of different kinds of stories.
Yes.
Like,
I think it's that. It's kind of.
Yeah.
But it goes back to what we were talking about with structure and things like that, which probably bored half of your listeners. But it's kind of.
No way.
it is kind of, I think if you know how to tell a story, you can go, like, I've written a bunch of horror things the last few years. Mm-hmm. And at roughly the same time as I was writing Varroa Varroa, there's graphic novels, which were a series of young adult graphic novels, you know, aimed at the young adult market. But if you know how stories work, I just think, you know, you can flip genres. I've never really liked this thing of, like, you're that guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I remember sort of, I think Dan Didio, when I worked at DC at one point, went, oh, you're the sci-fi guy. And I went, oh, well, sometimes. I mean, I can do other stuff as well, you know. And so Petrolhead actually came, the approach came out of, I was writing for a young adult audience with Roy of the Rovers, and it was quite freeing because you strip out a lot of the kind of, the more kind of sort of adult sort of trappings of storytelling, like internal captions and monologues. You know, what you're trying to do is, I found was with Roy of the Rovers, would tell a very direct story that would appeal to a younger audience. And as a result, I thought I wrote some really, really good character stuff in there. And I kind of thought, well, I'd like to take that approach into a comic going into the mainstream American market. And I'd got to know Pai Parr, who was the designer on 2000 AD. And Pai was doing these amazing posters of, like, futuristic racing cars and stuff. And I'm not really into cars, funny enough. If anyone's read Petrolhead, I've done a comic about futuristic racing cars. But it was just, I really like Pai's work. And I said, look, you should do a comic with these. They're just, this is nearly a world already. You've done a lot of it had a tone to it. It had an optimism and a fun about it. Do you know what I mean? It felt bright. And it felt like the time was right because we were in the middle of COVID at that point. I think it was like, oh, I've had enough of miserable comics. So we have some fun, bright, you know, fast paced comics that have got a bit of life to them. And
it's interesting you describe it that way because it's still kind of a post-apocalyptic nightmare world.
Yeah, I can't
get just a bit of fun
from my sort of, yeah, essentially alive.
I can see what you're saying and it's there, but there's a context.
We like to have our cake and eat it occasionally.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But we started sort of building Petrolhead together and building a world and, you know, writing the characters. And again, we both come from 2000 AD, but it was very much kind of trying to go, well, we want this to appeal to an American audience. We want this to appeal to an image readership. So we're not coming in, but we are taking certain tonal things from our 2008, what we love about 2008 as well. And then trying to make it feel a little bit like a kind of Pixar movie on the page at times, as well as maybe it's a bit more anime in places. So we're chucking all this stuff we love, both of us, into a blender and kind of Petrolhead's what's come out of it, really. And we've both, you know, absolutely loved it. And we're sort of, you know, there's, you know, we've been sending each other little messages back and forth at times going, you were reading the issues going, this is really good, man. This is, it's just, it's turned up.
You can tell that when you get a page back. Oh, we're doing it. This feels good.
But it's like, that's great. It's a character, the characters, sometimes, you know, characters come alive when you're writing them. And with Petrolhead, the entire cast, to the point where you would throw in like a character like Dave the Bird in, who wasn't even in the initial pitch, basically. But then I got to the script point and I was thinking, I've got an entire scene with Petrolhead alone in his garage, living on his own, and he has no one to talk to, you know? So that sometimes through necessity, you make up a character, and that character then suddenly becomes one of your favorite things in the entire book. And that happens quite often, I find, and that's a really lovely surprise. You kind of go, no, I know, I've got all the building blocks and I know exactly what this is. And then you start writing it and a voice just pops onto the page and you go, yeah, that's a great character.
Where did, I mean, if you were to describe this story, like, where did you start? What is it you, like, we should have this? Other than, I guess you saw drawings of cool future cars.
Yeah, robots. And Pai was drawing these, like, robots and stuff. This is his bag, you know, robots and futuristic racing cars is very much Pai's thing. So I sort of came in and I was kind of, well, I need to build a story around this and build characters around it. And then it's just giving them a reason to go on the run is the blatant, cynical, you know, that's your storytelling job, right? Someone's got to be chasing them. and they've got to be getting somewhere. And why? What do they want? And why are we going to be invested as readers, you know, to want them to make it? So that's my job then. But really, the designs, I mean, a lot of it, I was coming up with the characters, and I remember sort of the moment we came up with the name Petrolhead, like, you know, the type of, I said the direction to Pai, which type of thing an artist will hate you for. He goes, he needs to have petrol belching out of his head, basically, you know. It's like pretty basic. And then we go back and forth, and you know, with the designs, and sort of we, so it's all sort of, you know, it's for good or ill, the entire book is entirely Pai and I, and it's been a blast. It's been a lot of work as well. I mean, because Pai, like, he draws it, he colors it, he letters it, he designs that book, and it looks glorious. Yeah, the colors are just part of his world.
Absolutely. You said he was a designer, but did he do sequential before this?
He did some sequential. He did a strip for 2008 called The Intestinauts with Arthur Wyatt, and he did a series of horror heavy metal graphic novels in the UK for an independent publisher. But I mean, he was, you know, one of the, you know, nice things about it was just, like, you know, the American market had no idea who he was, and then he sort of hit, and sort of issue one came out, and sort of quite understandably an awful lot of people were going, who is this guy, you know, where's he come from? But it's
felt like I'd missed something. I thought, because, you know, there's a lot of new artists, new in quotes, they've been working for 5 or 10 years, and, you know, I read a lot of comics from people who are newer at it, and so to see an artist that you've never heard of come along and be sort of fully formed in terms of being able to design an amazing amount of characters and a whole world, and then be able to translate that into sequential pages that have motion and narrative, and it's a hell of a thing. It's a good book.
I knew he was good, but as the pages were coming in, those little sort of character interactions and the acting performances from the characters was just kind of like, holy shit, he's really good, you know. And so that was I knew the book would look amazing, and I knew the design of the world and the characters would all be amazing. But it, you know, that's when a comic sings, I think, is when you've got an artist who, and you know, I can write the best dialogue I can possibly write, but it's in the hands of the artist whether or not that's going to come across on the page. And it totally did, which was really lovely.
Yeah. I mean, and extra lucked out because the colors are also spectacular, because a lot of that can take down a lot of books too, and just is really a complete package. I think it feels like this is a world you could live in for a while in a lot of different ways. How long are we planning on doing this story? And, or is it open-ended, or how long does it go?
Issue 5 comes out this week. I don't know when the podcast's going online, but issue 5 is in shops March the 13th, something like that. And that's the end of our first arc, and then we're going to have a break. We're planning currently, the thinking is to do like the Hellboy model, where we'll come back for different mini series, maybe one a year, and keep the story rolling, because we'd love to, you know, do it as a monthly ongoing, but we're probably doing every aspect of the creative process. It's just kind of like, it's not possible to do that. But we love it, and you know, we've just signed with, you know, a deal with the film and TV rights, so we'll see what goes with it, you know, what comes from that. But it's, if we can carry on doing more and more of it, then great. But it's like, we've the graphic novel is going to be out in June. It's going to be like this beautiful collection, and hopefully that sells enough, and we can warrant, you know, keep doing more of it, because at the end of the day, it's all about the market.
Sure. Well, I hope all that works out real well, and I'll do my best part to keep it going, just for me.
That's just for me.
Rob, I think I'm going to let you go. I could keep talking to you for a while. There's lots of other things I have thoughts about, but we both have lives we got to get back to. And so much for taking the time. I know it's a little later over there for you, so I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it, Josh. Thanks a lot. It's always frightening when people are asking you about stuff you did early in your career, because, frankly, I've forgotten most things I did 4 weeks ago, let alone early in my career. So
I understand.
I know the truth.
I am also a middle-aged man who doesn't remember why he walked into a room, and that's totally fair.
Indeed, which is like when it comes to writing. I did an interview for the 2003 podcast the other day, and they were kind of going, well, how many episodes is this story you're on to talk to us about, Rob? And I just blankly stared at the screen going, I don't know. Why am I supposed to know? I only wrote the thing.
Thank you, Rob Williams, for spending all that time with me. I say this every time, but I could have kept going. It's like, well, all right, we got to get back to our lives now. But just what a great, thoughtful writer with so much diversity of story type. It's just all over the place, and in a great way. And I just thanks for spending the time with me. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks to the patrons of iFanboy, patreon.com/iFanboy. This Talksplode thing is a thing. It's continued to be a thing for quite a while, and I want to thank folks for that. You can go to iFanboy.com to listen to all the other shows that we've ever done. Of course, this is our weekly Pick of the Week podcast when we talk about the week's comics. Thanks for listening. Bye. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.